Welcome back to This Week on Channel 9. I'm Brian Keller.
I'm Dan Fernandez.
And we've got a big show in store. We've got...
your missile launching codes?
Yeah, maybe some making waves with XNA.
Silverlight and Facebook.
And let's jump right into it.
Yeah,
but first, our top story, yeah, Silverlight.
Exactly, baby. Now, this is what we used to call Silverface. Mm-hmm. Scott Guthrie demoed this at PDC. The client is now available. It does require Silverlight 4 installation, but it does work on PC and Mac.
Nice. This is hot. I've seen some of the internal Microsoft people kind of playing with this and posting stuff to Facebook, and it's definitely a really cool way of surfing Facebook.
I absolutely love it. Now, the one thing that, for those of you who have a crazy inbox, this is the one feature in Facebook that I've been able to clean out my inbox.
Your inbox
for messages?
Oh, yeah.
This has integration into inbox and allows you to have a much faster way to go through your messages.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Nice.
So you go through this, add this on here, and you'll be able to read and delete. In fact, it actually shows you another preview pane where you can kind of see what's going on with that person. But I really like this. Tim Heuer has a deeper dive if you're interested in just seeing sort of like a feature tour of all the features as well.
What I want to know is, how does this help me with Mafia Wars?
It does not actually
not
include Mafia,
sir.
But it does include the ability to see YouTube videos directly in line.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'll take it.
Yeah. All right.
Nice. So, Coplex now supporting Mercurial. What's up with that?
What's the deal?
And so, you know, actually this is kind of causing a lot of people to say, hey, is Microsoft abandoning TFS? And
Did you cry at night?
No. Maybe tonight, actually. But actually, Brian Harry, who a lot of people know, is kind of the technical fellow behind Team Foundation Server and was one of the original guys who invented SourceSafe and everything else. He was actually one of the people to propose this change. The reality is, and I've spent a lot of time actually digging into tools like Git recently, and Mercurial kind of works the same way, where you have a decentralized way of storing your source
distributed
code.
Distributed version control system, DBCS.
Yes, acronym central over here. But the appeal of that for an open source project is, let's say that you start an open source project out on Coplex, which you have one. It's called the World of Warcraft.
Treecraft add-on studio.
Yeah, you got a few of them, right?
Yeah.
And let's say that I want to take that project in a completely different direction from you, and we don't get along, and you hate me, and this is went the wrong direction quickly. But let's just say that I wanted to create another version of your project. Well, today, I would have to go create a new account somewhere, find somewhere to host that project, and then think about, okay, maybe you do want to take some pieces of mine later on. Well, there's not a great integration system between Codeplex and SourceForge and whatever else I might be hosting on. Whereas with a distributed version control system like Git or with Mercurial, I can just take my current repository, get latest off of you, and then just start checking in locally, and you're good to go. So a lot of people in the open source community like having that. It's not necessarily the way that enterprise software development works, which is why we built TFS the way we did. But Brian does mention that at some point in the future, he envisions that we will be doing something to make TFS also give you the ability to work with this model.
Interesting.
So, should be interesting.
That is very cool. The hints for the future for DVCS for... Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. Which, again, unpaid interns, us, we don't know anything, but this is straight from Brian Harry's blog.
Yes. So one thing to note is the tool that people are using for this is Tortoise, which is people probably know from Tortoise SVN or some of those tools. The tool for Mercurial is called Tortoise AG, and they actually explained why, which I didn't understand why it was called it, or maybe it's HG, which is the symbol for Mercury. That's why I was like, not, yeah.
So, nice.
There you go.
That's hot.
Yes.
Get it? Mercury.
And
hot.
Now
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Okay.
So seated right about here yesterday, I'd say, was Chris Perillo doing his first help desk episode.
Yes.
How did that go? It's a pilot episode, so what's the verdict? How did this go?
Yeah, well, I think the network execs want to push it back one hour. No.
Oh.
No, nice. No Conan
jokes. They're not getting our time slot.
With Coco.
Yeah.
I think people liked it.
Yeah.
I think it was good. A lot of variety, and, you know, this is unrehearsed, so, you know, there's people going, I don't know the answer to that question. We did get to see Gov Maharaj, who's a superstar internally, just in terms of his responses to the Windows 7 technical discussion.
Right. So,
and future Channel 9 star, I think.
Yep, I absolutely agree.
So I think this was. I think this is good. It seems like the plan is they're gonna keep doing this.
Nice, nice. So when do we find out when the next one? Just watch Channel 9.
Watch
Stay
Channel
tuned.
9 intimately. Don't just. Keep clicking F5 and don't go to bed at night.
Excellent. That's really going to help our stats.
Yes.
So this one was interesting. It took me a little while to wrap my head around exactly what was going on here because this article is server-side image resizing with WPF. And I'm like, wait a minute. WPF is a client-side technology. What's going on here? So so what this article is about, and it's by...
Bertrand Leroy.
Thank you.
From the ASP.NET team.
Oh, right, of course. So Bertrand takes us through how you can use... really, it's the libraries within WPF, which are great at handling things like image manipulation. Take advantage of those libraries on the server side so that you can resize images. Maybe you're serving up a web application, and you need to be able to dynamically generate an image based on what parameters get passed on, you know, when a user requests it or something like that. So he basically takes you through how to use the WPF libraries for that. Alternatively, you can also use GDI Plus, but the problem with that is it's not supported. So if you use the WPF libraries, then you are in the clear. It's supported on the server side, which is kind of counterintuitive, but he points it out how to do that.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. So some pretty cool stuff there.
Yep. So what's this? GPS driving from our friend Pete Brown, right?
Yeah, exactly. So Pete's been doing some cool stuff with WPF 4, and this is using a typical Streets and Trips GPS device in his car, and he actually used the Windows Sensors and Location API and does the plotting of a graph using the latitude and longitude. So he's got a nice video with Benny Hill music.
Nice, nice. Big fan.
Yeah, exactly. And where he's actually driving around, and you can see, those are actual latitudes and longitude, like he does, goes to Arby's and a bunch of other stuff. So.
Nice, nice. So here's the question. Can you take this graph, I think he says he goes, drops his son at Roly Poly's, which is somewhere, find the Roly Poly's, find the Arby's, and then reverse engineer, and then find your way to Pete's house. You can do this?
Yes, or you can just, you know, in that video, take a really close look at the latitude and longitude, and then, you know, stalk him.
Nice, and I understand that Pete has a t-shirt for the first person that shows up at his house between the hours of 3 a.m. and 5 a.m., so act fast.
Yeah, you just have to be holding a knife at the door.
Yeah.
So, I think it's really great when, you know, people endanger their own family for a demo. So,
yeah, sorry, Pete.
Kudos, and we'll send flowers to the fam.
Yeah, you're going to feel awful when that happens. Okay, so so what's up with this? So Tina put together a video showing you how you can find a bunch of PowerPoint
Yeah, actually,
templates.
I believe this is originally done by the Office MVP team, but the same thing, point being, is you're going to start building a PowerPoint rather than designing your own PowerPoint. You can now watch this video and you see all of the cool different PowerPoint styles and templates available for you, right? So it's like, you just watch the video and you kind of get inspired in terms of the visual design, and there's ones with animation, motion, you know, where text comes in and out or rotating around an object, and some of the crazier things you can do with PowerPoint paths.
Okay, so that's cool, but how did they arrive at 157 PowerPoint templates? Like,
I know. It's like, it would just be silly for us to release if we only had 156 templates, man. That's going to look stupid. We'll look really professional if we do 157.
Nice, nice.
158, that's
too
much.
That's a little excessive, man.
Yeah, the people are going to be like, what are you guys, rolling in money?
That's a good good strong bad. I like it. So you use this. This is an Excel viewer control. For Silverlight 4?
Yeah, so for those of you that are looking for ways to, one of the most common ways for representing data is obviously just in terms of OOXML, right? OpenXML. To be able to take that format of Excel spreadsheet and actually read it into Silverlight. So this shows you, and the code is open source, we can drag and drop a file on there, and it'll populate it with actual data into a Silverlight data grid. And now it has very basic graphing capabilities. Like, I don't think there's a bar chart, but it does have, like, the ability to do a line graph based on that data.
Okay.
So, but if you're looking for a simple example on how to use the Excel viewer in Silverlight, or how to build an Excel viewer in Silverlight 4, this is it.
Right. And so, and if all you want is how do you crack open XML with with Serverlight 4, you can just use that piece of the sample as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So it does the whole walkthrough, too.
Yeah, so if I was building, say, you know, a set of coordinate or a list of coordinates for how to find Pete Brown's house, then this could be an app for me. I'm just saying, just throwing it out there.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Okay. You know, you could literally do the dump there.
Okay, excellent. What you can do with Serverlight 4's comm feature. We're kind of big on Serverlight 4 this week.
Yeah, well, you know, we've talked about some Excel stuff, mm-hmm. some PowerPoint. So we got our Office, mm-hmm. we got our Office Groove on. We got some ASP.NET stuff later. We got some Silverlight. So we're trying to be fair and balanced.
And speaking of fair and balanced, let's talk about Comm Plus, because, you know, we don't often talk about Comm Plus.
It's what's old is new again. So this was a tutorial I found through Rudy Grobler. It was pointing to somebody else's tutorial that is the best discussion of all the things that having Comm Plus in an out-of-browser application gives you.
Okay.
So I'm just going to list these out. So obviously, reading and writing a file to anywhere. Running Notepad and actually writing something in the document.
You mean like actually interacting with the accessibility hooks?
Yeah, because I believe you can do send keys.
Wow.
Right? So you can read a user's registry. So that's read, not write. Add the out-of-browser application to the startup menu so that you can actually, you know, have it automatically
like
start
click
up.
Click once kind of thing, yeah?
More like maybe you're running a service in the task tray or something like that. Taskbar, so you can pin an out-of-browser application. You can pin another application to the taskbar. Use text-to-speech, or execute SQL insert statements, or use WMI. So a lot of really cool examples on things that are now going to be capable of doing in a Silverlight 4 application.
Gotcha.
Now, one of the keys, though, is these Comm Plus features are not cross-browser.
Oh, of course. Yeah, so because it's IE only?
No, I'm sorry, cross-platform. I should have said.
Gotcha, so it won't run on a Mac, in other words.
Yes, because, you know, it'd be AppleScript, maybe.
Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah, so some of the automation stuff might work, but not really.
Okay, good point.
Extensible output caching.
Yeah, so I want to talk about this. So, all right, before the show, we talked about output caching. We talked about how ASP.NET, since version 1, it can help you cache the output at the, I guess, at the application tier as opposed to the data tier, so that unless something changes on the back end, you can basically set up an event system to say if this table changes or if this column changes, then let the application tier know. Otherwise, you can just serve up that data straight to the presentation tier without having to hit the data tier. Is that kind of an accurate?
Yeah, so there's a couple ways that you could have done it, right? So you could have done it in like your middle tier business logic, where you're actually referencing the libraries and you're controlling the output cache there, and you're using like your own custom output cache validation logic. The other part is where you had, you know, ASP.NET markup with server-side controls, where you would put in output cache and then something like a vary by param, which you'd vary by this query string parameter, for example.
Okay. And so that's been there since ASP.NET 1. So what's different now with ASP.NET 4?
So the big thing is the extensibility of output caching, right? So now instead of saying, here are the ways that you can output cache, I think it's database, XML, by, you know, something in the query string. I think there's some other things around session or user.
So you're talking about like changing the data provider then.
Yes, I can now switch out and say use an implementation of some middle tier object cache, and it's built for extensibility now.
Okay.
Right? So like, you know, a lot of people are familiar with, say, memcache, which is a way that PHP uses as a object caching mechanism.
Right.
For, you know, scaling up massive amounts, you know, folks, Facebook is a big implementation, et cetera.
Gotcha.
You could, for example, have your own extensible output cache service, and people can build a provider, and they just need to, I think, have a four method interface, you know, how something's cached, moved, et cetera, et cetera. The point is, Scott Gu goes through. People that aren't familiar with this, new feature in ASP.NET 4, you can now plug in and build your own providers for this.
Gotcha. Okay. Very cool.
Yeah.
Nice. Good explanation. So along the same vein, editable routes, how to make better use of editable routes. So if you wanted to have an ASP.NET application and have one set of URLs that map to a different location on your server, you can do that with routes. But one of the challenges is that
you may be putting in your global ASA, which means you'll recompile. So what ways can you actually make it so that you can change those routes? And Phil goes through two mechanisms. Mm-hmm. To be able to do that. First is using a file system watcher.
Sure.
The challenge there is, and he went back with David Ebo's suggestion, is that'll actually cause a request to have a full trust.
Right.
So that won't work, or unless you're in a full trust scenario, and then it'll work. But then actually using the file in app_code. For the route changes, everything will work. And this is interesting because it happens to be something that the Channel 9 folks were, or I should say Duncan was working on with
VisitMix.
With VisitMix, exactly.
Nice.
Right.
Nice.
So it's the one thing that may actually be useful for Duncan.
Excellent.
Yeah.
He needs to watch the show.
I sent him the link.
Okay, so he doesn't need to watch the show.
No,
sorry.
Yeah.
Hi, Duncan.
No.
So this next one is how to actually query your Azure logs. So, like your operations logs, your event logs, all that good stuff for your app running in the sky via LinkPad.
Yes.
So you can create your own custom applications to monitor how your applications are doing and kind of set up your own like mom style monitoring. I think this is going to be a huge area of growth for a lot of people to build apps around.
Yeah. So Storage Explorer doesn't necessarily give you the best way to say query your data. Like, mm-hmm. hey, maybe I just want to see all warnings or all warnings yesterday or
right.
all warnings yesterday that you know contain the text. Blah.
Or all warnings from tomorrow. That'd be nice.
Right. So that.
What's going to happen?
All warnings from tomorrow.
Yeah.
All information. Yeah. So that is a very link or SQL type thing, right? So mm-hmm. I start with the query, I get this, and then I'm going to filter based on this new condition, filter mm-hmm. based on this new condition. So it actually walks through and is a great example of where link lets you see the data that you really care about.
Gotcha. Cool. Link to Azure logs. Okay. So destructor versus finalizer. I actually remember reading up on this back
Gozer the Destructor, yeah.
Sorry?
Gozer the Destructor. That's
what?
The name of an Eric Gunnarsson article on.
Oh, no. I don't remember that. But I remember reading about this when .NET first came out, reading up on C#, trying to figure out the difference between Destructor and Finalizer. And Eric Lipper takes us through a pretty interesting discovery, which is he's basically pointing out that the C# spec originally got this wrong, got the difference between a destructor and a finalizer wrong.
Yeah, in right? 1999, when they were taking the... May 12th, 1999.
Yep.
And he actually goes through some of the history in terms of the language team. And, you know, just quick recap. Destructor, and the easy way to remember it is destructor is deterministic, meaning I'm going to know exactly when that object is gone.
Because
finalizer,
you're calling it.
Finalizer means I'm putting you on the final checklist,
mm-hmm.
and the garbage collector is going to take care of you and
at
clean up your
point.
Memory
yep.
at some point based on when it's ready to.
Yeah, when it's good and ready.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. It is not finalized.
Yeah.
Destructor is, bam,
gotcha.
Deterministic. So
yep.
The use of the terms in the C# spec uses destructor, and it turns out in the CLI spec they actually used finalizer. So I think it's kind of an interesting in terms of the misuse of the word,
right?
Where people expect destructor to mean one thing when really it means finalizer.
Gotcha. All right, bringing up old wounds there.
Yes.
Speaking of old wounds, what didn't get into Visual Basic 2010?
It's not old. Come on. This is a product that hasn't even shipped yet, and we're already throwing it under the bus.
Well. Hold on, though, because some of these things...
I'm waiting for Visual Studio 2013.
Some of these things are old wounds, like iterators, like the fact that Visual Basic doesn't support iterators and then was supposed to support iterators for 2010 and then now doesn't support iterators. That's kind of an old wound. So, but in the interest of making this constructive, the Visual Basic team wants your feedback. They're being very transparent. They're saying, hey, here are the things that did not make it into Visual Basic 2010,
mm-hmm.
and take a look at them and let us know how we should stack rank these for Visual Basic 11.
Yeah, so they, I do think this is good in that, you know, one of the hardest problems is when you have a product, whatever mm-hmm. the product is, you have to make those cuts. Some feature is not going to make your list.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's, you know, it could be dependencies on another team, it could be whatever it happens to be. So
yeah.
They put this out here. Here's the things that we want to get on our wish list for the next version of Visual Basic. What do you all think about these? Are these important? Which ones are more important? And why? So it's really sort of opening up and talking about, like, what are your priorities for building your product?
Right. I do have to say, though, that that from a J-sharp perspective, we did get everything we wanted into this release, didn't have to cut anything. So props to the team for that. It was it's really amazing. So we talked about making waves with XNA earlier. So this is making waves. So this is an article on how to write a shader, basically, that makes it look like you're on an ocean. So this is going to be great. I don't know if you know this, but for the last 15 years, I've been writing my own pirate simulation game.
Oh, really?
And so I'm replatforming it onto XNA right now. So yeah, it's going to be pretty awesome.
What language are you using to write in?
Well, it was J sharp, but now it's C sharp.
Yeah. That's right.
Well, after you guys finally fixed the whole finalizer destructor thing, I figured it was okay to use. thanks for getting around to that.
What's important is that you're writing in C#, not J#.
Yeah, but this is how to use HLSL.
The answer should have been HLSL, actually.
Well, for the shaders, yeah. But I mean, come on, you're not writing the whole.
I'm just saying.
App.
You could have. That would have been clever.
Really? Yeah, I am clever.
High-level shader language.
Yep.
Which is a way to describe some crazy math that for things that you want to do with objects, polygons.
I gotta say, man, I've tried to sit down and like just follow a basic HLSL sample before, and I do not get it. So hats off to anybody who can actually write this stuff.
Yes, absolutely.
It's hardcore. So.
Yes. So, but for those of you that want to learn, here you go.
There you go.
This is how you do it.
Or so, just copy and paste. That's what I do.
Kudos to Lewis.
Yeah, look for my pirate game.
Picks of the week.
2017. Picks of the week. So what's
like
this all about?
Duke Nukem forever.
Dude, they finally admitted defeat and canceled that project. Did
no.
you see that? Yeah, there was a big article.
When?
Like 3 months ago.
Why did we not cover that on This Week on Channel 9?
Someone was having a baby.
What?
Yeah.
Did you cover it?
No. It was actually over the holidays, I believe. So maybe it wasn't 3 months ago.
All right, well, we're going
to
follow up on this.
We
on this breaking story.
Yes, F-sharp missile launcher.
F-sharp missile launcher. So I believe it is Chris Smith, get the name right, did an intro to F-sharp programming. Mm-hmm. But rather than doing the boring, let's talk about our data types or whatever, he decided to sort of do like a Dr. Evil, take over the world.
Yeah. He did a talk at CodeMash.
Yeah.
And his talk was titled something like "How to Be an Evil Warlord with F#." And all of his demos were based on taking over the world and doing like very Stewie Griffin kind of stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking Pinky and the Brain, but so he shows how to use the USB powered missile launcher.
Mm-hmm.
He shows how to use speech and what is it? OpenCV, the facial recognition.
Oh right. Yep.
Open source libraries, and all using F# to build a missile launcher app. So
that's awesome.
Check out his slides, check out his code. This is fun stuff.
And Clint might be working on building one of his own.
I think we need to pass this out for like everybody on our team.
Yeah, everyone does need to build this.
This would be awesome.
Build your own.
Yeah.
That'd be cool. And so my pick of the week is Sharp PCAP. And so this is a code project that is basically a .NET network packet analyzer, if you will. And you know, I saw this and I had to pick it, and I'll tell you why. My car was broken into yesterday, and I started to get really paranoid. Like, okay, my window's smashed, they took my GPS, whatever, I'll buy new stuff. But at the end of the day, like, I was thinking, gosh, did they get my identity? Do they know where I live? You know, what kind of stuff did I have in my car? And so I started to get really security conscious. And so when I saw this, it actually took me back to the days when I was working at a company, and we totally forgot what the password for one of the servers to check its email and get alerts was.
Yeah.
And we couldn't figure out what the password was. It was like entered into the software, and we didn't know what it was. So I was like, all right, let me see if I can hook up a network packet analyzer and sniff the traffic. It is so easy and scary to see just what happens when you do this plain text stuff, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I started to really think about like my network passwords and like all of my security options at home. And so it's kind of a roundabout way of saying this is an interesting exercise, I think, for anybody to go through to understand just what kind of traffic goes over your network and realize just how insecure that weakest link is when you're talking about SMTP traffic or like plain text passwords that get sent out. I mean,
and
it's
more
really
importantly,
bad.
You know, in our watching community, if somebody saw somebody break into a Saturn around Building 24 Wednesday, let us know.
Yes, exactly. Or if anyone sees someone breaking into Pete Brown's house, let us know, because you could win a prize. No, not really. Seriously, don't leave Pete alone. He's a nice guy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Who puts it? Yeah. Oh well. On that note,
it's been a great episode. We'll see you next week.
Thanks.